Marsha P. Johnson, who'd been dubbed the Queen of the Village, began a powerful civil rights movement for gender nonconforming people as a leader in the Stonewall riots and as a founder of the first trans rights organization. In a film called The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, we follow Victoria Cruz, a domestic violence advocate and counselor for the Anti-Violence Project, as she investigates Johnson's mysterious death, leading to questions about the high rates of violence still being suffered by the trans community. It opens today at the IFC Center, and I'm very pleased to welcome the film's director, David France, back to our show, along with his subject, Victoria Cruz. Hello.
Hello.
It's so good to be here.
Victoria, she was called the Queen of the Village, but you've called Marsha P. Johnson the Rosa Parks of the LGBTQ community?
Yes, that's the way I feel, that she's like the Rosa Parks of the gay movement in our community.
There's a beeping sound here. Is somebody's phone going off? Ah, okay. I was wondering what that was. I thought it was a truck that was backing up into the studio.
I know, it seemed dangerous.
So she was the Rosa Parks of the community?
Yes.
Did either of you know her?
I knew her. She was one of the first people I met when I moved to New York, actually, in 1981. And she was one of those kind of everyday fixtures in the village. If you knew her, if she recognized you, if she called out hello to you, you felt welcomed in her community, and she personally made me feel like I had a home in New York.
Was her sense of fashion one of the things that made her the queen of the village?
Absolutely, and her joy.
She was ahead of her time as far as fashion is concerned.
What was her style like?
She was a woman who threw off all convention. She frequently wore a crown of flowers. She had befriended many of the people who worked in the flower district, and they made sure that she had a fresh supply every morning. And she wore outfits that were designed of kind of everyday things. Like there's a story of her going into a bathroom once in the village, and she had to pass through a beaded curtain to get in. And on her way out, that beaded curtain was her dress.
She also wore taffeta dresses, like in ball dresses, but she put sneakers on so she'd be comfortable.
Who was Sylvia Rivera, and what role did she play in the story?
Well, Sylvia Rivera was a friend of Marsha's, and there was a sister love affair there. When I knew Sylvia, she always talked about Marsha, and she would always with a tear in her eye, like she missed her.
Didn't they feel left out of the LGBTQ activism after the Stonewall riots?
Well, after the Stonewall riots in 1973, Sylvia gave a speech at Washington Square Park, and she was booed.
For what reason?
For the same reasons that they're not accepting of the trans community.
By the gay community?
By the gay community, yes.
David, can you tell us about STAR, the Sweet Transvestite Action Revolutionizers?
Revolutionaries. These women were revolutionaries. You know, they were at the Stonewall the night of the riots. They played a pivotal role in the skirmishes there. And as the dust was settling from that, they joined with about a dozen people to help form the first of the modern LGBT rights organizations. And within a couple of months of that, they started STAR, which was an organization, probably the first of its kind, to advocate for the rights of transgender people.
Focused largely on people of color?
It was founded by people of color. It didn't necessarily focus on them, but it focused on people who were in need and people who were, as they called themselves at the time, street people, living without means and on the margins even of the gay community.
Does STAR still exist today, since both Johnson and Rivera are no longer alive?
It doesn't. When Rivera, right before Sylvia died, she relaunched it. She died of cancer, and she changed its name to the Street Transgender Action Revolutionaries, part of the entire evolution of the concept of transgender.
Why were the circumstances of Marsha's death suspicious?
Well, the community felt that Marsha had so much to live and so much to give for the community that she would not commit suicide. She had so much to live for.
But it was ruled as a suicide?
It was first ruled as a suicide. As a matter of fact, the community went on an uproar, knowing the way she was. And in her autopsy, it was circled possible homicide, which threw in a doubt.
And has the reaction of the community changed over the years?
No, it hasn't. It's always been a kind of a, not just a mystery, but a source of great anger and frustration in the community. And, you know, it, what the film Death and Life of Marsha Johnson follows is Victoria Cruz's reinvestigation of the case. And we learn through her and through the evidence that she gathers that, in fact, Marsha was afraid for her life in the last couple of weeks of her life, that she had reason to be concerned. And that was known pretty well at the time, and that's what fueled these massive demonstrations that we've discovered in archival footage from them.
And I'm talking with the director of the Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, which opens today at the IFC Center. It's David France. Also with Victoria Cruz, who the film follows. Victoria, why did you decide to investigate Marsha's case?
I think that it's part of our history, and it needed to be told. And it's time. Nothing happens before it's time.
Did you receive any hostility or pushback?
Not really, no.
How did you start working at the Anti-Violence Project?
I started working at the Anti-Violence Project after hair-raising experience I had in Cobble Hill Nursing Home. I was sexually and physically assaulted by female nurses. And
what was the reason for that?
They wanted to know if I was trans, if I was real, if I was a cis woman or what. Whatever their diverted minds. Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you've experienced at other times?
Oh, well? Yes. Trans women usually face things like that.
So you assume that something similar had happened with Marsha?
That I don't know. Hmm. But then a friend referred me to the Anti-Violence Project. It took me 3 days to call them. And when I did, I called them at 1:30 in the morning. They have a 24-hour hotline. And the person understood what I was talking about and what I was feeling. And she took it from there. We went to the precinct. I gave the names and of the women who had assaulted me. And we went to court.
And what happened?
Well, they served community service and a fine.
There was a conviction.
Yeah, there was conviction. Four of them were convicted. And
is that surprising? Is there often a conviction in cases like that?
Well, most trans people wouldn't want to get into the legal system because they feel that nothing's going to be done.
How did you connect with David? I'm wondering whether it can feel kind of intrusive to have someone following you with a camera all the time.
Well, I had just retired, and David had called AVP, and they referred David to me. Unfortunately, I had retired. I was doing me, so I was avoiding him for a while. But like I said, nothing comes before its time. And one day I got bored, and I looked over at my table, and I saw his number. I said, let me see what these people want. I called them up. We set up an appointment, and as soon as that elevator opened, we just clicked.
And how did the people you were dealing with react to the camera?
What do you mean?
Well, were people comfortable, David, being filmed?
Well, first I should
because
say...
Because we're talking about a community that's can feel rather under attack.
Exactly. I should say that Victoria was so natural with the camera that she was able to forget that we were there. And I had gone to the Anti-Violence Project, which is a nonprofit here in the city, part of a national network of organizations formed to respond to violent crime against members of the LGBT community. And Victoria had started to work there following her assault, as she was saying. I went there because I knew that they had done a serious investigation into the death of Marsha at a time when the police and prosecutors were paying no attention and following up on no leads 25 years ago. And I wanted to find out what the Anti-Violence Project had discovered then, and that's what Victoria agreed to show me. But then her investigation took on a life of its own, and everybody that we encountered, with the exception, notable exception, of members of the NYPD and the district attorney's office were happy to try to go and find shed a new light on what might have happened then.
Let me throw in another name here, Islan Nettles. Who was Islan Nettles, and what was the outcome of her case?
Islan Nettles was a woman of color, and she was, let's say, given flowers from somebody, like, let's say, compliments about her beauty. But upon finding out she was a woman of trans woman of color, the person got really, really upset because he was mocked by his friend, and he beat her to death.
He couldn't have just walked away?
In front of a precinct and in front of cameras.
Is that common?
Yes,
are
it
rates
is.
Of violence against transgender women disproportionately high?
As of last 3 weeks ago, there have been 21 murders of gender nonconforming people, and 18 of those murders have been women of color.
And David, should I assume that what you said earlier would suggest that the police and the criminal justice system isn't always as sympathetic as it might be in other kinds of cases?
It is, unfortunately, across the board, less sympathetic than it needs to be, as though transgender victims of crime are somehow complicit in their victimhood. And I think when we set about to try to understand what might have happened to Marsha, we thought we were going to be telling telling that historical story at a time of good news for the trans community, a time of great visibility, a time of kind of cultural conversation around incorporating our trans sisters and brothers into community. But what we discovered through the lens of Victoria and the Anti-Violence Project was that there's this ongoing and increasing epidemic of crimes in the community, and that the response to those by the criminal justice system is still wanting.
And then yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions ordered the Justice Department to take the position in court cases that transgender people aren't protected by the civil rights law that bans workplace discrimination based on sex.
Just outrageous.
That's so true. That's why I'm so grateful when Christine Quinn offered me a job. I was on public assistance at the time, and she says, "I want you in my team here." And I said, "Of course, it beats welfare."
That's at the
and ADP. There I was able to not only help myself, but my family and the community.
Do you think making this film helps you or makes the trans community feel like it's being treated a little more fairly, with a little more concern?
Well, I think, you know, there's the stories of transgender resistance are not often told in ways that reach the community, and I think that the story certainly of Sylvia and Marsha is one of resistance and of triumph, and just seeing yourself reflected in and your community reflected on a screen is such a powerful point. I remember in the late 70s when I saw my first film that had gay and queer representation on screen, and how important that was, and how moving that was, and affirming that was. And I think we're at a place today where each one of those opportunities to tell those stories has a direct and lasting impact on the community.
In the earliest days of films, it was experimental filmmakers,
right,
like Kenneth Anger, who addressed those issues.
Exactly. And
when did it become mainstream?
You had to go and find those festivals or someplace to see them screened. I remember that film Making Love, which came out, I think, in 1981 or 1982, was the first of the kind of mainstream using actors who you recognized, directors, and, you know, the techniques of Hollywood brought to bear to tell the story of a very familiar story of coming out in the gay community. And that was not that very long ago. Things have changed so much, at least for the white and cisgender part of our community.
Victoria, beside the Anti-Violence Project, what are other resources available to the trans community?
Other resources available is the Gay Lesbian Center, SAGE for adult gay and lesbian and trans people.
Seniors, right.
And seniors.
Why do you think there's still so much confusion here? Is it partly because when somebody, a a cis person meets a transgender person and doesn't know that she's transgender, he feels threatened. His sexuality feels threatened.
Maybe his own sexuality feels threatened. He's got doubts about themselves, but unfortunately, it happens all the time. I know that if I'm approached by somebody, I tell them right away, even if they laid a hand on me, wait. Because, you know, it's their own insecurity that pops up, not mine. I'm secure about who I am and what I am.
We're also in a period of increased and kind of turbocharged hatred and division in this country. As you mentioned about the Jeff Sessions directive. But
the military earlier,
I know,
rejected the president's call for dealing with transgender people in a different way.
Right. And the president's call was really a kind of a pandering to hatred itself. And I don't know. I think we're in a period now where the people who are the most marginalized in our society, and certainly our transgender sisters of color, are at that extreme, are at much increased danger for their own personal safety, much less this question about employment. And employment opportunities for the trans community are limited, and that's a serious problem for the community, and often forces a lot of people into the sex industry, which is creates its own series of risks and exposures.
The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson opens at the IFC Center at 323 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village today. Also on Netflix, David France will appear for a Q&A at the 8:55 show, and my great thanks to him and to Victoria Cruz for coming by on our show to talk about the film.
Thank you.
Thank
for
you
having
for having us.
Us.